On Friday evening, Stephanie and I got to host a big neighborhood potluck, meet some new neighbors, have a good time with them. And while at that time, I discovered that there are millions of varieties of mushroom. I didn't realize just how diverse the mushroom world was. And what that means is that there's not one person in the world who fully comprehends mushrooms because they're so diverse and vast. And that was a good thing to learn. It also relates to our message because if people can't even understand the greatness and diversity of mushrooms, then maybe it's not surprising that Paul presents a mind-boggling, paradigm-shattering God when he visits the intellectual capital of the world. And that's what happens here as Paul is in Athens, and we're continuing today with the adventures of the first church in Acts. We've been there for some weeks now, but here Paul indeed makes his way to Athens, which at that time was the center for philosophy in the world. Rome and Athens were the two big cultural centers. And so we'll get to see what happens there and how that too relates to us today in our context, which it definitely does. So I'm going to read from verses 16 to 34. And then, even before that, I'm going to ask God to lead our time so we can hear what he has for us now. Father, we praise you for your word that's living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword. Give us insight this morning, Lord. Give us grace. Increase our wonder at who you are and equip us to fulfill our calling here in our communities, in our cultures, in our circles, Lord, through what you have in your word. Amen. So I'm going to jump in middle of this chapter, starting in verse 16, with Paul in Athens. Now, while Paul was waiting for them, his companions at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took hold of him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might find their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. And even as some of your own poets have said, 'For we indeed are indeed his offspring.' Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. But others said, "We will hear you again about this." So Paul went out from their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysus the Areopagite, and a woman named Demarius, and others with them. All right. So in this passage, Paul brings the message of Jesus into an idol-dominated culture. But he does that in a way that sets the pattern for us today. I'm going to start by reading a description of this city that Paul found himself in from a commentator, help give us an idea of where he was at. Let the reader keep in mind that this address was spoken in the literary capital of the ancient world, the most cultured city of the earth, to which every Roman who sought a finished education resorted to complete his studies, the home of the philosophers, orators, sculptors, painters, and poets, and the great university where many thousands of strangers were gathered for study. So one of the important facts that we should observe from this passage is that Paul went here, and he didn't think, "Whoa, where am I? I need to get out of here. This is the wrong context for the gospel." But rather, no, this type of place needs the good news brought to bear on it as well. What we're going to do is look at Paul's pattern and especially hone in on three things: his distress, and then his engagement, and finally his presentation or his persuasiveness and the content there. All right, so we'll start with Paul's distress. It says he was provoked upon seeing the proliferation of counterfeit gods. The word that is used there to describe Paul's inner response implies deep feeling, strong emotion. It's a combination of pain and anger and compassion all wrapped together. And that inner fire that we see Paul experiencing there is also reflected in what we see in Jesus, where on the one hand, he clears out the temple in Jerusalem in holy anger, and at the same time, this Jesus looks over that city and weeps with compassion. And both those responses spring from the heart of love. But this deep feeling is very significant. So what is it that sparked Paul's provocation? It said, as he perceived, the city was full of idols. And once again, there's more going on than him just seeing a bunch of statues. Some of them may have been pretty erotic. However, what he was perceiving was the counterfeit gods that these statues represented. So he wasn't just seeing a bunch of statues. Beneath the surface, he was observing the city is full and controlled by false gods. Of course, in our part of the world, it's not so common to see statues all over the place symbolizing various deities. However, our culture here and now is just as full as Athens was of false objects of worship. That's because an object of worship is simply whatever a person invests with greatest worth. So everybody has an object of worship. To worship is to ascribe something ultimate value. So someone's actual God is whatever they esteem most highly, whatever they most look to for security and hope and happiness. That's their God. So that means, yes, everyone in the whole world is worshiping something. That's not just a category for so-called religious people. Everyone's looking to someone or something as their greatest hope or security or happiness, their greatest meaning. And it can be any created thing, any good gift of God that takes his place as the highest object of hope, of adoration. And that's idolatry, anything that replaces the living God himself. And it's that that had Paul provoked. So what are the gods that dominate our culture today? Well, like Athens then, there are countless options. In America, one of the most common ones is freedom. That is a common, highest value in place of the giver of freedom. And common culprits in every time and culture are money and sex and power. But it can also be safety, or physical fitness, or health, or traditional family. So the options are endless of these created things, gifts from God, that can be put in the place of God Himself as the greatest thing. So, do you know what common idols are in your circles? We should. So we should be discerning. We should be aware, even when we don't have statues all over the place symbolizing these things. It may well be that there's a magazine devoted to every kind of false god. But in any case, we should be aware. However, what we see in Paul is that being aware is not enough. The greater question is, do we care? Paul didn't just look at these statues, idols, and think, wow, a lot of diversity here. Fascinating. Instead, this heart of idolatry grieved Paul. It bothered him. He was jealous for the true God to have the worship that he deserved, and he wanted the hearts of the Athenians to be given to him. So maybe it's not really very hard for us to think for a little bit and see what some of the false gods are, false objects of worship in our society. But there are some wrong responses that we can have to the idols in our culture. Here are a few examples. First of all, we can take the posture of isolation, withdrawing from our culture. We can try to withdraw as much as possible from our culture and its pursuits. But the problem is that if we simply try to isolate ourselves from the public square, to be as disconnected as possible from our culture because of all those false gods out there, then we're probably just making an idol of our own comfort or our own personal ease or peace or security. See, so that tactic doesn't work. Simply be isolated from the culture and all of its false objects of worship. Another, on the opposite side of the spectrum, is response of accommodation, over-accommodation. And that's the opposite tendency is isolation, but it's also deadly. So what that means is we accept our culture's values as our own. So for example, our culture idolizes endless comfort and entertainment. You can't have too much. But do we? Or our culture's current highest value seems to be for you to be true to yourself. So the question then is, are we taking that advice and applying it? Or are you instead denying yourself daily and taking up your cross to follow Jesus and find your life in Him? So these are two natural wrong responses to the values of our culture, of isolation or over accommodation, over assimilation. And Jesus addresses this also Himself, because think about what it means when Jesus calls us to be salt and light. So if you're outside in the dark and you take out your phone, because that's where most of us use our flashlight now, and you turn it on to find whatever the case may be and stick it in your pocket, obviously it's no help to anybody. That doesn't help. So Jesus calls us to be light that is visible, publicly engaged. But then He also uses the metaphor of salt. You know, and if salt is spread in food, it's meant to, at the time Jesus spoke, it was a preservative as well as seasoning. And so if you imagine your stack of French fries with white sand on it instead of salt, you can imagine it's probably not as pleasant to eat. Bland and unpleasant. And so Jesus said, if salt has lost its tastiness, it's useless. So with that analogy, you're meant to be immersed, involved, and permeating every part of the food, every part of the culture, but at the same time distinct, so that that power to preserve what's good and bring seasoning is still present. So those two metaphors give a picture that's very different from either isolation, light that's hidden, or assimilation or over-accommodation where there's no difference between Christians and the culture around us. Instead, it's light and salt that's doing its job. One other posture I'll mention is that we can simply be condemning toward our culture, writing it off. And yet that too is very different from what we see in Paul. That can be hard to avoid because idolatry does result in all kinds of problems in society and families and individuals, all types of sin. And so some of that can be very repulsive to us, and some of it should be. But for Christians, disgust is not enough. That doesn't go far enough. It's true that putting any object in God's place causes endless damage to people and to culture and society. And we should be grieved and distressed and burdened, but disgust doesn't go far enough. So you think of Paul here in Athens, he could have seen all these counterfeit gods around him and thought, I'm getting out of here. This is just not pleasant. I'm going to stick with the synagogue. Or he could have written off the city in disgust. Or he could have just tried to fit in. You know, he's waiting for his buddies to arrive. That's what we read at the beginning. He could have thought, well, I'm going to really lie low until they get here and then we'll see. But instead, he took a very different pattern. He engaged. He brought the truth to bear on the culture in which he found himself, as crazy and confused as it was. So where did he get such a pattern, such balance? Of course, we know Jesus had looked from heaven and looked on our crazed, confused world. And he hated our idolatry, just like Paul. Jesus hated our idolatry, but he was also moved with compassion. And so he longed to free us from our false objects of worship. And that means that he dove into the sea, the crazy, you know, raging sea of our humanity to rescue us. If Jesus had just looked and wanted to sweep our idolatry under the rug, he would have been betraying his own beauty, his own justice, his own perfection. But instead, he dove into the world. He became a human being in order to rescue us from our false objects of worship. He didn't turn his back to us, and instead, he took our sin on his back so that he could return us to God. And that's where Paul got the pattern. And the fact is that only when we see the beauty of Jesus' heart toward us will we be able to move toward our own cultures with the same pattern, rather than falling into one natural response or another, just writing it off or withdrawing or over-assimilating. So Paul followed that pattern of Christ. And because he was impassioned from within, this led him to engagement. So we looked at Paul's distress, and look at his engagement. Paul's spirit was troubled by the false gods, but then he acted in courageous love. So he had the discernment, the sorrow, but then he went beyond them to engage with the people. And this means getting close enough to ask questions and listen and understand and respond. So after beginning with the Jews and the devout Gentiles in the synagogue, which was Paul's practice, then it says he went to the marketplace. That's the Greek word agora. When we hear marketplace, we probably think of grocery store, maybe farmer's market or Walmart, but that's a very, very different idea than what that word communicates, because at that time, this would have been the place, the center for cultural activity in the whole city. It would have been the place for hearing news of current events, because there was no newspaper, internet, TV, so the Herald would bring the news to this place. It'd be for the display of the arts. Political debates happened here, financial interactions, all in this town center. So one commentator described it this way: the Athenian Agora was the center of the public and business life of the city, and people met there every day to learn the latest news and to discuss all manner of subjects. Temples and government buildings, shops and offices, and altars and statuary filled the agora, and stoas and colonnades gave protection against the summer sun and the winter rain and cold. So today we don't have a single location like this, physically speaking. We tend to separate our shopping from our political debate, from our art display, various places. And a lot of these, you know, activities that would all have happened in this area happen in a variety of different places today, like theaters or talk shows, community groups, banks, cafes, bars, art centers. So it's not our usual practice to have one place that converges all these things. Now, the exception might be some social media like Facebook or Twitter that come close, where it's one place where you can share art and engage in dialogue about controversial issues, hear the news, and have financial transactions. Fascinating. And so, ironically, despite the fact that a platform like Facebook or Twitter is not a physical place, it may be more similar to the place where Paul went than most, you know, than any grocery store or what comes to our mind when we hear the word marketplace. However, here's an appropriate application that one commentator made. We, like Paul, must go to where the people are, and to those settings where serious discussion of ideas, even religious ideas, is natural and expected. That was the point. He went to a place where it was normal to be talking about ideas, because that's what people did there. So that, of course, raises the question, where is the place where you will encounter people with whom it is natural to engage in meaningful conversation? For years, that was a difficult, thought-provoking question for me. Because in my job running a lawn business, I have fairly limited interaction with my customers, my employees, and it's usually brief, to the point. And, of course, much of my other time was consumed with family or church responsibilities. So that question of where's the place where regular, meaningful interaction will happen was not as clear. Sometimes I would have meaningful interaction with our neighbors, and that was good, but it wasn't as much as I would like. So for me, this year, joining a local running club has given me far more opportunity for this kind of meaningful, regular interaction with people outside of the church than I've had in years. And that was a healthy development in my life. But that's me. And so the question again for you is, where for you might be the best context for interaction with people where engaging and meaningful conversation is the norm, expected? Because that's the kind of context Paul was in. And we need to look and think about similar places for this in our own lives, whether it is our neighborhood or our workplace or some community location, whatever it might be. So that's significant. He went to the agora. But in addition to the place that Paul went, it's really significant how he interacted. The word translated reason in this context implies a back and forth conversing. And that would have been contrasted with what he did at the synagogue, preaching. So in this context of the marketplace, Paul wasn't standing on a box and proclaiming the truth in the same way. Instead, he's presenting the reality of the good news in a context of listening and understanding and responding. So preaching at the synagogue was a good thing, and there's a place for that kind of monologue. But the key to notice is how Paul changed his tactic with his different audience, different place. He didn't just do the same thing. It's like, oh, it's time to give a speech. but rather in this context he conversed, which involved listening and hearing and then responding, asking questions. And we must do the same in terms of adapting our strategy to the context we're in. Now, eventually, the interest in Paul's interaction as he spoke about Jesus and the resurrection in the marketplace did get him a hearing, and so he was taken to the Areopagus. And this was like the center stage. That's the one person called it Athens' chief legislative and judicial council. All right, so the interest in his interaction give him a place in the spotlight to then proclaim more directly. And that brings us to Paul's persuasiveness, his presentation. There is so much that is involved in Paul's brilliant address here on Mars Hill that it's hard for us to go very deep or to do it justice. And we won't do it justice, but we'll try to get into it somewhat and talk about what Paul was doing there. So, first of all, Paul adapted his presentation to his audience. We see that this message in Athens on Mars Hill is so different than the message that this apostle will give other places in the book of Acts, in the synagogue. And it wasn't that he was compromising the gospel out of fear of man. Instead, in this context, he was using wisdom and love to bring the truth to bear on the people in this context in a way that would connect with them more effectively. So Paul wisely adapted his presentation to his audience. Just quickly, we can learn some things. I'll go through these observations. We see that Paul knew the culture and he demonstrated his understanding of it to his audience. He showed respect to a degree by entering into their philosophical questions and quoting some of their own writers. But then he challenged the false promises of their beliefs and he set the stage and pointed to the Messiah. So I ran through those observations, but what we're going to do is take a closer look at this by looking at three focuses of Paul's interaction, three main focuses of his persuasive presentation. So first of all, the inadequacy or inferiority of counterfeit gods. We could summarize one of Paul's main points in this speech as your objects of worship aren't big enough. Your gods aren't great enough. So around us and we ourselves, most of the things that we tend to idolize are good things that are over-elevated, whether it's our children, our career, or physical beauty, or physical pleasure. And we can affirm the goodness of these things, but then, like Paul, we must challenge the inadequacy of these things as objects of worship. Now, just to cover their bases, the Athenians had this altar to an unknown god. You know, what if we missed one? I know, build an altar to the unknown god. Okay, good idea. So they did it. And Paul uses that altar to an unknown god as a symbolic springboard to point to their need. And their need was knowledge of the one true God, the God that they don't know. So it's as if Paul says, I notice that you are an incredible, worshipful people. Let me tell you about the only God who is truly worthy of worship. In Athens, there were idols of intellectualism and education, philosophy. I've heard it expressed as a place, it's almost as if Oxford and Cambridge or all the Ivy Leagues were thrown together into one location, and that was it there at the time of Athens. But they were a very philosophical people, and we don't have time to dig into all the history of Greek philosophy. However, let me summarize by saying that past Greek philosophers who influenced the people Paul is speaking to, they'd attempted to find the unifying reality of existence. They'd attempted to reconcile the unchanging nature of things with the ever-changing nature of things. You know, so how tried to figure out how things that are constantly fluctuating, relate to things which are never changing. So one philosopher had made the memorable statement, whatever is, is. Profound. And then another one had countered with the idea that whatever is becoming. That you never step into the same river twice. Maybe you've heard that one, because the waters move and your cells have changed, and etc. So which one is it? Whatever is, whatever is becoming. How do you reconcile these things? Well, Paul came along and he showed how the living God was the fulfillment of their philosophical quandary. From his opening point of connection, Paul gets to the glory of the true God, which is very good news. And actually, that brings us to his second big focus. So after the inferiority, the inadequacy of their false gods, Paul lands on the glory of the true God. And Paul proclaims that the ultimate unifying center of all reality is not an impersonal substance or idea, but a personal reality, because it is a person. In him we live and move and have our being. Wow. And we are his offspring. So that uniting reality of all existence is the unchanging ever-being one, and then all that he creates is ever-changing. Wow. So by quoting their own sources, Paul appeals to the latent knowledge within them. It's, as one teacher put it, it's as if Paul, he doesn't go forward with the attitude, I'm going to prove that God exists, but rather, I'm going to prove that you already know he exists. And that corresponds to what Paul writes in Romans 1, that men suppress the truth in unrighteousness, though they have an innate sense of reality. So it's like we know some things that we don't like to acknowledge to ourselves, to other people, but within human beings, eternity is on our hearts such that there is truth that we have some sense of, but we suppress it. And Paul appeals to that. So in our day to day, this includes things such as people fighting valiantly for human rights, despite the fact that in a worldview of naturalistic evolution, there's no basis for human rights. So why are they doing that? Or it also shows itself in people's violent protest against injustice. When in a relativistic world without moral absolutes, there's no basis for defining justice and injustice. You know, so for a culture that insists that all morality is relative, we sure do have a lot of moral outrage going on. So what we need to learn to do, like Paul, is help people see the inadequacy of their false beliefs by making it clear that some of their conclusions don't line up with some of the beliefs that they have. That the technical term for this is presuppositional apologetics. That's a long term, but the idea is simply using some beliefs that people hold to show them that they're inconsistent with other beliefs that they hold themselves, and therefore be able to point them to the truth that would make their beliefs consistent. A few weeks ago, we talked about how the dominant philosophies in Paul's day were Stoicism and Epicureanism. So Stoics, they're kind of like moralists and relativists, actually. Would be an oversimplification, but that in some ways relates to the views today. So Stoics, they sought a kind of moralism that would steal their hearts from pain by avoiding over-attachment to anyone. You know, then you can avoid pain by not loving anything too much, all right? But that, you know, didn't work for a lot of people. And then Epicureans lived for temporal pleasure. And you would think that would be probably more popular, but both of these dominant philosophies overpromised and underdelivered. Because human beings were created by God for loving relationships which require deep emotional investment. And on the other hand, we are created to know a better pleasure than merely superficial ones that end up leaving us empty. So, because of this, we're made to know the real satisfaction in the true God that motivates us to share it with others in love. And the point is how Paul exposes the vulnerability of the prevailing philosophies and how the true God not only shows them to be false and inferior, but offers a more satisfying alternative. Paul describes the true God that both refutes the philosophies of the day and at the same time offers to fulfill the deepest longings of people's heart. The paradigm-shattering God. That's what we can see when Paul starts talking about the true God, that he is bigger and better than the categories of the day. So this God is independent. Everything was made by him. He needs nothing from us. We don't need to earn his favor. We can't, because he's not a deity who can be appeased by our work. He actually already has everything he needs. So he can't be controlled. And in fact, he controls, he rules all things. But then this same God is also personal. He tailors, Paul says, he tailors all the details of our lives. This God actually wants us, a close relationship with us. He doesn't need us, but he wants us. So Paul, in his brief words here, paints this picture of a God who's transcendently glorious and at the same time intimately personal. We could never work our way to him, but he's done the work to come to us and bring us near. We see Paul referencing judgment. Judgment is coming for mankind's refusal to believe, but Christ has taken the judgment for whoever turns from their false gods and puts their trust in him. So can you begin to see how this presentation of the true God is more desirable than anything that we can put in his place? The reality is better than what we could imagine. So Paul's presentation appeals to both their mind and their heart. However, as glorious as the reality he's talking about God is, it could somehow seem abstract. And before Paul finishes, he does bring it back down to earth, quite literally, because the third point he emphasizes is the historical fact of the resurrection of Christ. Now, for Christ to be raised means that he had to die and be buried in the earth. So, once again, this transcendent creator God was killed and buried in a tomb. What God is like this God? By bringing, though, Paul's focus to the resurrection of Jesus, he's taking it out of merely philosophical or abstract theoretical level and making it something that's measurable and able to be evaluated or proved. In that time that Paul is speaking there in the Areopagus, the resurrection didn't fit into any of the philosophies of the day. So, therefore, people scoffed. It's like, what resurrection? What a ridiculous idea. However, if only the resurrection of Jesus was disproven, then the entire Christian faith would fall apart. It's a pretty simple way of ending this upstart faith. However, it never was. And to this day, the fact of Jesus' resurrection is the linchpin of the entire Christian faith. The problem is that that reality commands a response. It's not something that we can just theorize about. I mean, the nature of God, as if it was all in the realm of intellectual thought and theory, but rather the resurrection of Jesus commands a response. It did to them then, and it does to us today. It proves that Jesus is who he said he is, and that he accomplished what he promised he would accomplish, and that he is coming again to judge the world. So that historical fact that's been validated by historians and by what we see with the early church, that fact of Christ's resurrection commands our response. The fact is that disprove the resurrection of Jesus and you can really do whatever you want. But if the resurrection of Jesus is true, then there is no possible reasonable response but to bow down and worship him with all that you are and all that you have. That's the only logical response. And that was true then, and it's true today. The only appropriate response is to turn from our counterfeit gods to the true and living God and the Savior he's provided. So, Paul's presentation exposed the inferiority of the counterfeit hopes and philosophies and gods, but then it proclaimed the glory of the one true God, and then he ended on the fact of Christ's resurrection. Back then in Athens, most of the intellectual elites scoffed. Paul had given a masterfully crafted message, but at the time, it was largely dismissed. So just because you give an outstanding presentation of the truth does not mean it will be effective. The gospel's good news to the humble and bad news to the proud. And we must be as wise and winsome and loving as we can, like Paul was then. But that won't ensure the results that we would like. However, we're still called to proclaim the glory of the one true God, knowing that our labor is not in vain. Even though most of the intellectuals at that time largely scoffed there in Athens, eventually the truth of Christianity infiltrated and dominated the Roman culture. And you know what? In our circles today, we don't know if our efforts will be met with acceptance or rejection. But we do know that one day the knowledge of the glory of God will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. And that's our certain hope. So therefore, like Paul, may we be involved. We get to be a part of preparing our culture for the coming of the one true God, Jesus. So let me close with these brief reminders that we've seen, which would be find the marketplaces, so to speak, in your life. Is it work or a park? Is it social media, your neighborhood, a community or club? Secondly, be burdened and broken by the idols that are ruining people's lives, because anyone or anything that takes the place of the living God brings pain and disintegration to our lives. Be burdened. Learn to engage with people, not just to make statements, but to ask questions and listen and respond, like Paul. And then finally, and even now, bask in the wonder of the glory of the true God and be confident in the power of God for salvation, which is the gospel of Jesus. It's working a power in itself. Let's close. Thank you, Lord God, for your truth that can break through the hardest of hearts, the most powerful false philosophies, and that frees us, Lord, to know you, to love our neighbors. Lord, I pray that you would move us to see you and rejoice in who you are. You'd move us to care about our neighbors who are in bondage to false objects of worship and to be engaged, Lord, like you have been with us. Make us your representatives and give us the strength to walk in a manner worthy of Jesus. Amen.